The Afterburn Podcast is a proud supporter of Guns Gear and Memorial Foundation, helping our veterans and their families when they need it most. To learn more, visit gunsgearin.com/rain.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The conflict would wreck the Taiwanese economy. It's important to know, too, that the Chinese suffer heavily. The losses and the fact of defeat might be enough to destabilize the Chinese communist regime. So they are betting their future on any invasion also. There's no Ukraine option for Taiwan.
Hey, welcome to the podcast. Thanks for listening and thanks for watching if you're over on YouTube. My guest today is retired Marine Colonel Mark Cancia. He is currently a senior advisor for the Center for Strategic and International Studies. We're going to kick the conversation off today with a Chinese invasion of Taiwan and what that might look like. He and his co-authors war gamed out. This is the largest war game, unclassified war game, of what it might look like if China decided ever to invade Taiwan. We don't talk about the probability, and that's not what the study is about, but I have that link down below. We also jump into the discussion about Ukraine, F-16s for Ukraine, and the Israel-Hamas conflict. He's written articles and papers on all those, which I have linked down below. As always, shout out to my patrons for supporting the podcast. If you're interested in There I Was stories, those now specifically live over on Patreon as well as Apple. Spotify is no longer a thing when it comes to There I Was stories. So if you're interested in those, if you're interested in supporting the podcast, feel free to jump over to Patreon and join in the fight or subscribe over on Apple Podcasts. And if that's not your thing and you're getting value out of this, a big shout out to all those who take the time to leave a rating or review over on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. But following the show, that makes sure you get up to date when the podcast releases, and it also helps the podcast get shown to more people because it shows more followers. Standard algorithm stuff. But again, if you're getting value out of this content, please take just a few seconds to make sure you're following the show, both on Apple and Spotify. That really helps me out. And if you want a There I Was story, jump over to Patreon. With that being said, I think we've hit all our admin notes, so let's jump into the podcast.
Tower, is released to you, runway 4 left, wind 040 at 5, clear for takeoff.
Sea tide, Altura 0 eyes, we're clear for takeoff, clear for the airspace.
Fire projector.
My program curveballs at 354.
Sir, thanks for joining me on the podcast. Happy to have you here and excited to kind of dig into some of the topics we're going to talk about, which is going to be China, Ukraine, Israel, and just hit a few highlights here. So again, thank you for joining me on the podcast. Over 30 years, the United States Marine Corps, both active and reserve, tours in Vietnam, Iraq. You've also worked a lot throughout the Department of Defense, both in the military, obviously, capacity, but in the civilian capacity and the Department of Energy as well. I'm sure I'm missing a few things. Is there anything else you think we should highlight?
The only thing I would add is that I'm now at a think tank, the Center for Strategic and International Studies, where I am a senior advisor and I write about military forces and operations.
That's really where I came about and I found you, which you had an interesting study where you had some war games with the Chinese invasion or potential Chinese invasion of Taiwan and how that might play out in the region, how the United States, how their allies would be impacted, obviously how the Taiwan and China would be impacted as well. And again, that's really where I'd like to kick this off. What was the impetus of doing the war games? What was the reason behind going through this effort to put forth?
Well, there are a couple of reasons. One, of course, is that this is a topic that has received a tremendous amount of attention. The Department of Defense says that China is the pacing threat, and there's been a lot of attention to Taiwan, particularly because of rising Chinese rhetoric and its military buildup. That doesn't mean an invasion or an attack is imminent or even likely, but it certainly is plausible. But there were a couple of other reasons that we started this project. One was that there's very little in the unclassified space about a conflict between the U.S. and China over Taiwan. The Department of Defense has done a lot of war games internally, but those are classified. Little bits and pieces come out. Those are fragmentary, and frankly, some of them are self-serving. We also wanted to do a war game many times. There are war games that have been done in various think tanks, and a lot of them are very well done and very interesting, but they're done once or twice, and that can be very educational for the people involved, but it's not a very strong foundation for making recommendations for policy. So we wanted to do 20 iterations. We ended up doing 25. And finally, we wanted to base the game on objective data, not a group of subject matter experts in the back room who were making judgments about whether cruise missiles could get through defenses. So we did a lot of operations research and historical research to come up with tables that we thought were as objective as possible. So the three things, or the four things really, hot topic, the need for unclassified insights, multiple iterations, and finally, objective analysis.
I should mention too, this obviously, this the war game report, which is a 165 page report, linked down below for those who want to go read it and dig a little bit further into it. It's a great report. Can you talk to me about how actually physically the war game was structured, some of the assumptions that went into it? How was it built and how was it executed?
It's important to note that there were three authors. I am one. It was three equal authors, a triumvirate. Another author is a fellow named Eric Hagenbotham. He runs a wargaming center up at MIT and came out of RAND, did a lot of work on Chinese military forces. He speaks Japanese and Mandarin. And the third is Matthew Kansian, runs war games at the Naval War College and has a PhD from MIT. And many people will note that there's a similarity between my name and his, and he is in fact my younger son. And that's why the game got started, because he and Eric were doing sort of a crude version of the war game for a foundation, and they were running it once or twice. And Matthew and I would talk about how they were running it. And that's when we got the idea that instead of running it once or twice and, you know, with a sort of prototype, you know, that we would apply for a grant to refine the game and then run it many times. And so we did that. The Smith Richardson Foundation gave us some money to do that. And that's where the game came from. We launched that about, it's 2 years ago now. And then finally finished it, published the results in January of 2023.
Now, the study or the report, obviously, it highlights the fact that you're not in predicting the probability that China would invade Taiwan. It's purely if it did happen, how it might play out. But you did pick the year 2026, if I read correctly. Is there a reason why you picked 2026 for the year that China could possibly invade Taiwan?
Yeah, and it's important to reinforce the point that you just made, which is we are not saying that an invasion is likely. We are arguing, though, that it is plausible, given the aggressive rhetoric of the Chinese leadership and the military buildup, plus the fact that an invasion would be the most dangerous course of action for the Chinese. We looked at that first.
And then for 2026, what was the rationale behind picking that year?
We picked 2026 for two reasons. One is that that was inside what's now known as the Davidson window. This is named for Admiral Davidson, who was commander of Indo-PACOM, and he said that the period sort of 2026, 2028 was a time of great danger because the Chinese buildup was continuing, but new U.S. capabilities would not be online at that point. 2026 at the time was also the end of the Pentagon's planning period. It's what's called its future year defense program. So we had a pretty good sense about what U.S. capabilities would be. So for both reasons, we picked 2026.
Okay. Can you talk to me, what would the invasion most likely look like based upon the wargaming that you guys executed?
We hypothesized that the Chinese would launch a surprise attack. The United States would see it about 15 days out, and the Chinese would take about 30 days to prepare their forces. We would see it 15 days out. The United States would take some precautions, move forces into the Western Pacific, increase the readiness of forces back home, but not execute a full TPFID. The Chinese would begin with a massive missile strike against U.S. forces in the Pacific and against Taiwan, and then launch its landing forces and its fleet to protect it. A key assumption is about Japan. The war game has about 20 assumptions, and we varied many of them, but one of the key ones was Japan. Our base case, which is the most likely in our opinion, was that the Japanese would allow the United States to use its bases in Japan, for example, Kadena Air Force Base on Okinawa, but would not participate itself unless it were attacked by the Chinese. Now, in about 19 of the 25 iterations that we ran, the Chinese did attack Japan, so Japan did come into the conflict. But the reason we took that as a base assumption is twofold. First, we tested it with many senior Japanese officials, and they were quite confident with it. They argued two things. First, that this was the path of least resistance for the Japanese. In other words, if they did nothing, that's what would happen. The United States would use these bases because we've stated our intention to do that, but they would not become involved. But the other reason they said was that if Japan did not allow the United States to use bases, it would be, in effect, tearing up its security relationship with the United States, which had safeguarded Japan for 70 years. And they believed that no Japanese government would be willing to do that. So for both reasons, we started with that assumption. We did run an excursion where the Japanese were entirely neutral. And that is very difficult for the United States. One of our insights was that the United States has to have access to bases in Japan because that's the only way we can get our TAC air into the fight. Guam is too far away for TAC air. It can be used for bombers, although it's still inside the Chinese missile defensive zone. But if we can't use the bases in Japan, then you know, all those F-35s and F-15s and F-16s just are useless because there's no place to base them. The United States has to fight entirely with essentially submarines and bombers with long-range missiles, and that's just not enough. That's one of the scenarios where the United States and its allies lose.
Obviously, this is an unclassified report, and there are assumptions being made upon capabilities. Can you talk to me about what those assumptions would be? If you're comparing 100 F-35s to the Chinese, the PLA, their Air Force. Is it just a probability table of 60 to 40%? Or what were some of those assumptions as far as the effectiveness of the different weapons?
Yeah, we used a lot of testing data to assess whether, what the effectiveness of all the different aircraft were. And of course, U.S. fifth generation aircraft are very effective. Interesting thing is that there was not that much air-to-air combat. And of course, there's a lot of attention on that. Can an F-35 or an F-22 take on the latest Chinese fighters? And those are important questions. But the on the U.S. side, the major focus was on striking the Chinese fleet. So there was a lot of use of TAC air to launch long-range missiles, in addition to escorting strike packages. A key insight about aviation was that 90% of U.S. and coalition aircraft losses were on the ground because the Chinese missile inventory is just so large that periodically they would sweep all of the air bases in theater and destroy dozens and sometimes even hundreds of U.S. coalition aircraft on the ground. One of the questions we raised was the value of expensive fighter aircraft. If you're going to lose 90% of them on the ground, you know, is it worth investing $200 million per aircraft for a sixth-gen fighter? Now, we don't answer that question, but we did want to raise that question. We also argued very strongly the United States needed to do two things to protect its tech air. One was dispersion, which the Air Force is doing a lot of. The other thing was hardening shelters, which the United States is not doing a lot of and needs to reinstitute. We did a lot of it during the Cold War, because otherwise aircraft are just standing out in the open and very exposed to these Chinese missile attacks.
Korea being one of those examples of HAZs, hardened aircraft shelters, where those are in place, but elsewhere those don't really exist. And you alluded to the dispersion of forces. We've talked on the podcast and other episodes about the ACE, the Agile Combat employment that's going on through the Air Force. Can you talk to, did that play any factor into the scenarios of how the Air Force is trying to disperse forces across the Pacific?
It did. And to start with the hardened aircraft shelters, the United States has some in Korea, of course, but basically we stopped building those with the end of the Cold War and haven't built any since. There are none on Anderson Air Force Base on Guam, despite the fact that Chinese missiles can now strike Anderson. So if the United States is going to use Anderson in a conflict with China, we've got to do something. And hardened shelters makes a lot of sense. On the question of dispersion, yes, we did play dispersion. We had dispersal bases, and that helps. There are two cautions, though. I mean, one is that we need the ability to disperse to civilian airfields because they are already equipped to handle large numbers of aircraft, and being able to use them then means you don't have to bring in as much infrastructure. The other thing is that there's a lot of interest in, you know, taking small groups of aircraft, six aircraft, and putting them in very remote airfields, maybe very austere airfields. And that is not really very helpful, because the problem the United States faces is you have to find bed down for hundreds of airplanes, and spreading them around in around the Pacific in groups of six or 12 doesn't get you very far and is an immense logistics burden. So yes, dispersal is important, but we need to think of ways to do it with large numbers of aircraft and leverage civilian capabilities more aggressively.
Another aspect of the study that you released, the fifth-gen fighter, the J-20 of the PLA. Engine technology is, again, something we've talked about on the podcast. Engine technology, I think, makes or breaks a military. The PLA, the Chinese have a tough time with engine technology. So, again, I know there's some assumptions there if you want to speak to that, but one thing that stood out to me was the fact that, again, we have to remember that 100 miles from China sits Taiwan. But for the United States to get into place to be able to support it, the Pacific Ocean is a vast, vast body of water with a lot of distance to cover to be able to reinforce, to be able to support, et cetera. Can you talk about some of those aspects?
I'm going to have to defer on the engine technology. My colleague, Eric Higginbotham, is the expert on that one. But there's no question about the tyranny of distance in the Pacific. And it's something that is difficult to appreciate when we've spent so much time focusing on Europe and the Middle East, where distances are not so great. In the Pacific, the United States has this tremendous problem about just getting into the fight. Even aircraft stationed in southern Japan, the mainland islands, still quite a ways from Taiwan, whereas the Chinese are right offshore. And what that means is that the Chinese can spend a lot more time over the island, either combat air patrols or for close air support, as opposed to the United States and Japan, you know, which can get over the island, but It just takes longer, and they can't have as much presence there. So that's a tremendous challenge to the U.S. and coalition side.
Can you talk to me about what the war game produced? What is there a common theme with the end result of the war game?
The major finding of the war game was that the United States and its coalition partners could maintain an autonomous and democratic Taiwan, but it comes at very high cost, a cost that would take many years to replace and might damage U.S. global position for many years, even decades. The conflict would wreck the Taiwanese economy. It's important to note, too, that the Chinese suffer heavily, and the losses and the fact of defeat might be enough to destabilize the Chinese communist regime. So they are betting their future on any invasion also.
And I know we should mention, too, right? Again, we're solely digging into war games. I think some things have happened in the news in the last 6 months that could be contributing factors, but we're not going to speak to that today. And again, I brought it up on other podcasts with President Xi firing a lot of his military. There's a lot of corruption and ties to missiles being filled with water, et cetera. And again, those obviously would be factors like anything else when it came to a conflict, but we're not digging into that today. Out of this, is there anything, what are the big bedrocks for the United States military, for allies, as far as preparation and recommendations in the event that an invasion is imminent or an invasion occurs?
Well, a key finding is that although the United States is able to prevail, it's worth enhancing deterrence so we never have to fight this conflict, and strengthening forces so that if a conflict does come, we can bring it to a conclusion more rapidly and with lower losses. We did have some people look at the results and say, hey, we won, what's the big deal? And our point is, no, the losses are so great, we need to avoid this kind of conflict. There were a couple of other big insights also. One was about how important Japan is. As we discussed, the United States can't get its tac air into the fight unless we can base these forces in Japan. Guam is just too far away. You know, in theory, with enough tanking, you can get an aircraft from Guam over Taiwan, but you can't do that day after day with whole squadrons. In theory, we might use the Philippines, and that's possible, although the Philippines have said that they won't do that for a conflict over Taiwan. They're very focused on the South China Sea. The United States has received basing rights or has had basing agreements for 9 bases in the Philippines. Most of those are oriented on the South China Sea, although a couple of them could be used in a conflict with Taiwan. And we did have excursions that allowed the United States to do that. But I say politically, very uncertain. Another major insight was that there's no Ukraine option for Taiwan. With Ukraine, of course, the United States and allies have sent munitions and weapons into Ukraine after the war began. The Russians have tried to interdict that flow, but have been unable to do that. That's not possible with Taiwan. The Chinese defensive bubble over Taiwan is so strong that you can't get anything in there for at least a month or two. In the games, we had several players who tried to do that. They tried to sail, for example, one of the Marine Littoral Regiments onto Taiwan. That convoy was always sunk. One team tried to fly some reinforcements onto the island. The C-17s were all shot down. So Taiwan has to start the war with everything it needs for at least the first month or two. Another major insight was the importance of munitions inventories. And these have been getting a lot of attention recently because of shortages as a result of the war in Ukraine and U.S. deliveries to Ukraine. Our war game also contributed to that discussion. We found that some major elements of U.S. missile capability, long-range anti-ship missiles, run out in the first couple of days. So the United States needs to expand those inventories. And Pentagon's doing that, but it's going to take many years. An additional insight is how different a great power conflict will be from the experience of the last 25 years when the United States has fought counterinsurgencies and regional conflicts. The leadership in the Pentagon, the service chiefs, recognize how different it's going to be, and they've stated many times about demands of a great power conflict, and they're trying to reorient their force structures. The problem is that the lived experience of the mid-level officers who have been in these regional conflicts is very different from what we would experience in a great power conflict. I think this is particularly true for the Air Force and the Navy, which for the last 25 years at least have operated essentially in sanctuary. Adversaries have not been able to get at our fleet and not been able to get at our air bases. The example I use is follow-on forces that land at Kadena Air Force Base on Okinawa. These follow-on aircraft will land on a runway that's very bumpy because it has been patched so many times after Chinese missile attacks. They're going to taxi past literally hundreds of wrecked aircraft that were destroyed on the ground. They're going to move into a barracks that was vacated by the previous squadron because they were all killed in the previous missile attacks. The hospital is going to be full of wounded. The golf course will have been turned into a cemetery, and they will be told, welcome to Okinawa, tomorrow you fly over Taiwan. And that is an experience the Air Force has not had since arguably 1944.
Yeah, I think probably the fair statement is World War III, that kicks off. You mentioned in the war game, are you war gamed as well? Can you talk to me about the civilian aspect of it? Because you alluded to there were scenarios where the Chinese would send a submarine off the West Coast targeting U.S. cities. Can you talk to the aspect of the civilian impact and how that might affect the scenario?
We wrestled a lot with Chinese capabilities and, you know, the notion of sending a submarine to the U.S. West Coast. We had some players who were very imaginative and hypothesized various kinds of cyber attacks, even special operations attacks on U.S. leadership. We finally decided to limit capabilities to demonstrated capabilities. You know, that is, if the Chinese or the U.S. had shown the ability to conduct certain operations, then we put those in the game. If they had not, then we didn't. And we recognize that there's some risk of surprise, but otherwise people come up with all kinds of, you know, interesting possibilities that either side would be really unable to do. So in this case, the Chinese submarines were mostly wrapped up with operations in the Western Pacific. And in fact, we see this across the board. That is, the conflict is so intense that neither side has a lot of capability to divert it to other goals. With the Chinese, of course, they're desperately trying to save their amphibious ships. With the United States, we're trying to attack the amphibious ships. And I would note that the amphibious ships, Chinese amphibious ships, are the center of gravity for the campaign. Some U.S. teams thought about conducting a deep attack on the Chinese mainland, strategic attack campaigns against infrastructure and political institutions, but they quickly found that they just didn't have enough capability to do that, which might have effect, but take weeks or arguably months, when the Chinese were landing troops on Taiwan and attacking U.S. forces. So the struggle around Taiwan really absorbs all of the military attention for both sides.
We did talk to it earlier, the 100 miles you have to cross. It's still 100 miles, not an easy thing to do. When it comes to the assumptions of capabilities of the Chinese being able to cross the Taiwan Strait in large numbers, how did that fit into the war games?
For all military forces, we assumed as the base case that they could execute the missions for which they were designed. So for the Chinese, that meant that they could use their amphibious capabilities for which they had built ships. Same for the Taiwanese and the Japanese, as well as the United States. Even with those capabilities, which were quite robust, and that assumed that the very high level of Chinese capability for joint operations and amphibious operations, even then, they struggled to get forces ashore and then sustain them. Logistics turned out to be a huge problem. We ran some excursions where the Chinese were not as skilled in joint operations and amphibious operations, and in those situations, they lost very quickly because, of course, the whole campaign focuses on their ability to do both of those.
I would like to segue, because you've written about Ukraine, you've written about Israel, but to segue between the two, with the wargaming in the report, you do talk about parallels between Ukraine and China and Taiwan. Can you talk about what those parallels are and what are not paralleled?
Are you a passionate aviation enthusiast? Then you'll be thrilled to hear about our sponsor, Aircore Aviation. This exciting company has been revolutionizing the aviation industry since 2008, and they have some amazing career opportunities available. More about that in just a minute. Aircore Aviation is at the forefront of airworthiness of legacy aircraft dating all the way back to World War II. Their dedicated team is involved in various aspects of aerospace, including manufacturing, fabrication, restoration, and support, using state-of-the-art technology. Their exceptional expertise in core manufacturing capabilities like metal forming, CNC machining, and complete aircraft rebuilding has led to the restoration of some award-winning aircraft, such as a couple P-51s, such as P-51 Thunderbird, Twilight Tier, and Sierra Sioux 2. And if you've been following me for a while, you might remember I was fortunate enough to fly over the Super Bowl in 2018 in Minneapolis. The formation was led by Sierra Sioux 2 alongside two A-10s and myself in the F-16, so this is a very cool full-circle experience. These incredible achievements have captured the attention of aircraft owners, aviation enthusiasts, and the general public alike. If you've always dreamt of a career in aviation, then Aircore Aviation is the perfect place for you. They are rapidly expanding their team in 2024 and have job openings in departments such as engineering and CAD, quality assurance, fabrication, and restoration. This is your chance to turn a passion into a profession. Aircore Aviation is offering some amazing benefits for full-time positions, including health insurance, PTO, HSA, retirement plans, life insurance, and the extra perk of enjoying Fridays off. If you're ready to be part of a team dedicated to fulfilling the dreams through the preservation of historical aircraft, visit aircoreaviation.com/careers today and take the first step towards an exciting career in aviation. Again, that's aircoreaviation.com/careers. Don't miss out on this incredible opportunity.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
There are a few important parallels. I think the big one is bad things happen. Before the invasion of Ukraine, most commentators, myself included, just couldn't believe that a country in the 21st century would invade a neighboring country and then try to conquer it. But in fact, that's what the Russians did. Some years ago, I wrote a report on what I called coping with surprise. And one of the points I made was that bad things happen. Unexpected things happen. Countries will weigh military decisions in a way that we think are unwise or misplaced. But they will do that anyway. Maybe their assumptions about military capability are different from ours. Maybe their assumptions about changing military balance is different from ours, and they feel that they have to move now. But for whatever reason, surprises, attacks happen. Of course, one of the classic examples there is Japan attacking the United States in 1941. The United States had done its analysis and thought that this would be a very foolish thing for the Japanese to do. And we were right. But they did it anyway. And the Japanese had done the same analysis. They weren't under a lot of illusions about their ability to defeat the United States. They intended to strike the United States hard enough that we got discouraged, but they recognized the risks also, but decided that the risks were worthwhile given the squeeze that was being put on the Japanese economy. So if I had to pick one major insight, you know, that comes out of Ukraine is bad things happen. And if the Chinese were to invade Taiwan tomorrow, no one would get up and say, wow, didn't see that coming. No, everybody would say, oh yeah, we've been expecting that for a long time. So it's important then to be ready for that kind of situation. A couple of other things come out of the war in Ukraine. And it's important to note one big difference is the war in Ukraine is primarily a ground war, whereas a conflict with China over Taiwan would be mostly air and naval. And that has actually been quite beneficial because it means that much of the aid that we have sent to Ukraine would either not be useful or not be as critical in a conflict in the Western Pacific. So there's some trade-off there, but not as much as might otherwise be the case. One thing that does come out looking at the war in Ukraine is first the need for adaptation. That is, unexpected things happened, and you have to be ready to adapt when your expectations are not met. Both sides are doing that. I think before the war, if you had asked people, what do you think the role of trench lines, fortifications, and unguided artillery will be in the next war? Many Washington experts would say those are irrelevant. Modern warfare is long range, precision strikes, small units operating autonomously. And of course, what we've seen is entirely the opposite. It looks like World War I with some 21st century weapons. And both sides have adapted to that. And that doesn't mean that new capabilities are not important. Of course, anti-tank weapons like Javelin and Enlos have been very important. And drones have been hugely important as ISR and as ways to direct artillery. Another surprise has been the strength of air defenses. We're not sure how that will affect a conflict in the Western Pacific, but certainly over Ukraine, the air defenses on both sides have been so great, it's difficult for aircraft to fly over the territory of the other side. In fact, you almost never see that anymore. The aircraft either just go right over the front lines, drop their ordnance and scoot, or they fire longer range munitions to stay out of air defense envelope. So you're seeing air defenses have a real impact on manned aircraft. One thing that's been very interesting is on the naval side, the Ukrainians have defeated the Russian Navy, driven them to the corners of the Black Sea without any of the attributes of a navy. They don't have any ships, and they don't have any naval aircraft. They've been able to do that with long-range precision strike, both anti-ship missiles, and that's what sank the Moskva, land attack missiles, which have attacked Russian ships at the pier, and then unmanned surface vessels that have tracked down and hunted Russian ships in their anchorages. So non-traditional capabilities at sea have been unexpectedly effective. How that affects a conflict in the Western Pacific, people are going to be thinking about for many years, but it's been a very striking aspect of the conflict. And finally, for air attack, the use of long-range drones, cruise missiles, but the kind of kamikaze drones that Iran has supplied to Russia have supplanted strikes by manned aircraft. Yeah, we don't know if that's going to be the case in the Western Pacific, but it's very striking that the air war is very active attacks against deep targets and cities are integral part of the conflict, but it's not being done in the way that has been done in the past.
It is interesting to see how things have been shaping up, and particularly if we just with current times and the Houthis, Red Sea, what off-the-shelf technology, Ukraine off-the-shelf technology, you see these farms where they're 3D printing drones, and just how these non-traditional means that popped up, how they're impacting the battle space. And I can only imagine that, you know, what would transpire if we actually went into a conflict.
Of course, the drones are a striking aspect of the conflict in Ukraine, and both sides, everyone is thinking about how that would affect conflicts elsewhere, for example, in the Western Pacific. Now, the situation there is different in the sense that it's air and naval. Most of the drones that are used in Ukraine are these small, cheap, expendable drones that are used either for ISR or, you know, have some small ordnance on them and, you know, used against personnel targets or vehicles. We have not seen much use of the large drones like Predators, Reapers, that were so important in the Middle East wars. How that translates to the Western Pacific, again, is a little uncertain. You know, our timeline, which was 2026, didn't allow for many of those capabilities to be fielded. For example, the Navy is looking at a lot of unmanned surface vessels, underwater vessels. Those might start to be fielded operationally by 2026. They're doing a lot of experimentation now. Air Force is running a lot of experiments with what they call loyal wingmen. Again, it's not quite, those are experiments. But you can see that those capabilities are on the verge of being fielded and making a major difference. And if there were a conflict, then you would see these capabilities pushed into the conflict, as we've seen it in Ukraine, where we would be willing to experiment, take losses, and pay the cost of putting immature technologies out into the field if we thought that it would have a immediate effect during a conflict where you're struggling to get any military advantage.
I would like to dig a little bit more into Ukraine, get your take, maybe specifically pitch towards the F-16 and the fact that they're getting them. Full disclosure, I've been a skeptic of Ukraine getting F-16s just from the training aspect, the logistical support aspect, runways, training maintainers, et cetera. But curious to get your take on, let's talk specifically the F-16 going to Ukraine.
Well, I think we're in the same place. That is, many people have noted the failure of the Ukrainian counteroffensive and have hypothesized that the air superiority to strike the Russian forces and protect Ukrainian forces. And then they say, therefore, we need F-16s. And when we get F-16s, then we can launch another counteroffensive with air superiority. And I think it's important to recognize that that's not going to happen for a couple of reasons. One is that just not enough F-16s. They're talking about 12 or 24. When you're facing Russian air power that's got as hundreds of aircraft, and of course, a very strong air defense environment. Plus, the Ukrainians just aren't going to have the auxiliary capabilities in terms of aerial warning, in terms of munitions, in terms of support aircraft, you know, that really are needed to go downtown, you know, and to be survivable in high threat areas. So F-16, huge psychological impact, huge symbolic impact, not going to make a big difference on the battlefield. But that doesn't mean that the Ukrainians need to give up on the air domain. They could do in the air what they've done at sea, which is to use non-traditional tools to assert at least local air dominance. And what would be non-traditional tools? Of course, these would be strikes against Russian bases. These would be long-range anti-air missile capabilities. This would be more drones with anti-air missile capabilities and probably more ground-based air defenses that as a package would be able to at least nullify, if not actually implement, air superiority over parts of the battlefield. So air will continue to be important, but it's not going to be conducted in the way that we have become accustomed over the last, arguably 100 years.
Yeah, very, very interesting. Again, those, I think the morale boost, the support aspect, depending, not to be political, right? There are people obviously for the support, there are people against it. But I can see the advantageous if you want to support morally and give a boost, hey, here's some really cool jets. The greatest fighter ever created by man, the F-16. But it is a very robust IADS you're having to deal with. You're learning a new Western jet, albeit doing training here, but to go and actually fly and fight in a hostile environment on day one, basically. It takes years to build that experience as a pilot to know how to best employ that aircraft. And that's completely skipping over, I think, the most important pack, the maintainers. That jet, needs a lot of maintenance and a lot of know-how in order to fix it. And you're having to learn a very complex system in a very challenging environment.
And that's absolutely true. And the psychological, political impact is important. I think it's also important to emphasize that there's no such thing as a game-changing weapon. From the beginning of the conflict, people have been pointing to certain weapons as game changers. And I talk to journalists a lot and I get a lot of questions, is this weapon going to be a game changer? And initially it was Javelins, and then it was HIMARS, then it was Patriot, then it was M1 tanks, and now it's F-16s. And I make the point, there's no such thing as a game changer. There's no weapon we can give the Ukrainians that will win the war. Now, all of these weapons cumulatively increase Ukraine's military capability, so it's worth sending them. But the fact that we're sending some particular piece of equipment is not in itself going to produce victory. And as a follow-on to that, what it means is that the United States and coalition partners need to continue the flow of military aid to Ukraine across the board in order for Ukrainian resistance to continue. So it's not as important that we send any particular piece of equipment. It's important that we continue to send a wide variety of equipment and lots of it so the Ukrainians can continue that resistance.
What is the importance, in your opinion, of that resistance? Because again, we go back to, I think now there's two camps, right? They're either for it and support the Ukrainians, or, hey, it's not my problem, not my fight. What's the take on that?
I think it's important to keep a couple of things in mind. One is that the Ukrainians are fighting this war themselves. They are not asking for any U.S. troops. There are no U.S. troops involved. This is very different from Iraq and Afghanistan, where U.S. troops are involved and fighting and dying, frankly. That's not true here. They're just asking for the tools to defend themselves. The second thing is that the cost is not very high when you consider it in respect to the U.S. defense budget and the U.S. federal budget. We've spent about $113 billion. Over the 2 years, we've spent about $1.6 trillion on defense. So you can do the math, it's about 8% then. And that $113 billion, that includes not just military support, but humanitarian support, economic support, a variety of elements. So compared to the federal budget, which I think is $6 trillion, I mean, it's very, very small. So the fiscal burden is very modest. What we're getting is the weakening of a major threat to Europe and the U.S. alliance of NATO. No matter what happens, the Russians are going to be quite weakened when they come out of this fight. The Biden administration, as well as the Trump administration and the Obama administration, had identified Russia as a major threat to the United States. So for a very small cost, we are weakening that threat and not losing any U.S. troops in the process. And it's important to keep in mind that, again, no matter how this war comes out, you're still going to have a hostile Russia on the other end. The Russian hostility to the United States and Europe and NATO goes very deep. And it goes not just in the Putin regime. It goes back centuries and millennia. The regime is revanchist. You know, that is, it wants to expand. It believes that it has a right to certain territories outside its borders, for example, the Baltic countries. So even if the United States cuts off aid and Ukraine is defeated, the threat is still going to be there. The Russians will just be a little closer and then be able to threaten NATO, where we have a security alliance.
Can we pivot to Israel? And again, you've written on Israel, the Hamas war that's been going on. Can I get a broad brush take on that? And then maybe we dive into some of the aspects of that.
Well, the war in the Middle East, of course, has been very brutal. It began with this massacre of Israelis. And now the Israelis are hammering Gaza with a lot of casualties, a lot of civilian suffering there. What's been interesting is that it is so heavily a war of precision munitions, whether launched from aircraft or helicopters or from the ground. The Israelis are doing that for a variety of reasons. One, it's much more effective, saves their own troops, and it also reduces civilian casualties, although there's no way to take those casualties to zero. The civilians are always going to suffer tremendously. There were a couple of times during this campaign I thought the Israelis might stop, but from the beginning, they have said that they intend to destroy Hamas, and that is what they are. That's what they are doing, and I expect that they will move into the last stronghold of Hamas, Rafah, at some point. Just talk about a deal of some sort. I think that this will not be a permanent settlement or even a major settlement. I think it'll be another exchange of some hostages for some prisoners and a ceasefire for a limited period of time. Otherwise, the two sides just don't have any common ground. Israel wants to destroy Hamas and get its hostages back. The Hamas wants Israel out of the Gaza Strip, which they would regard as a victory, because that would leave them in control of the Gaza Strip, and they would claim that they defeated Israel and, you know, kill a lot of Jews and are still there. So I don't see a permanent negotiation, a permanent settlement yet. I do see that some sort of interim settlement. Another question that arises is trade-offs of support among Israel, Ukraine, and Taiwan. And there are some trade-offs. Now, Ukraine is by far the largest recipient of aid. Israel has been receiving some elements, particularly precision munitions, for example, some artillery, some air defense, mostly things that Ukraine does not need, although there is some overlap, drones and artillery ammunition. Taiwan can use some of the items that are being sent to Ukraine and Israel, particularly the Taiwanese want to strengthen their ground forces. But because they are not in an immediate conflict, they're sort of third in line. Some of the things that they are receiving, Harpoon missiles, for example, aren't needed by either Israel or Ukraine, and those can continue to flow. So there is some trade-off among them, but fortunately not severe at this point.
So talking of all three of those, this is obviously outside the scope of the war game study we initiated or the discussion with. But when we look at supporting all these entities, if a major conflict did kick off with Taiwan and you still have conflict going off in Europe and the Middle East, is there a breaking point for the United States military, for the United States budget? Where is the point that we can no longer support all of these, or does that exist?
Well, there are two questions in there. One is, can we support these three allies, coalition partners who face existential threats in peacetime? And the answer to that is yes. I know that there are some trade-offs for support that we're providing, but so far they are severe. The United States has sent a lot of equipment, particularly to Ukraine. Now, Congress provided money to replace all of that, but it will take a couple of years for that new production to be received by U.S. forces. So there is a gap. There is some risk in that gap. There are some advantages, too, in that the United States forces will be getting new equipment. They'll be getting the most up-to-date equipment. The munitions will be at the beginning of their lifetime. They won't be facing expiration. So arguably, when all of this is delivered, U.S. forces will be in better shape, but there is this gap. If there's a war, whole different situation. A conflict with China would take really almost all of U.S. forces. In our war game, we assumed that we would pull out all of the forces in CONUS, continental United States, many of the forces overseas. The only two places where we left forces were ground forces in Korea and ground forces and a little air power in Europe, but everything else has to flow. So if a conflict with China broke out tomorrow, the United States would have to pull back its forces in the Middle East and its forces in Europe, turn those theaters over to our allies.
With China and actually Afghanistan, had we remained or had a presence stayed behind in Afghanistan, would that have threatened China or at least made them look towards their western flank? Is that something that's been looked at from a strategic standpoint?
I don't think that leaving forces in Afghanistan would have diverted the Chinese. They don't have any military forces aimed in the direction of Afghanistan, and we certainly couldn't have threatened their western flank. What would have happened is that there would not have been this precipitous, chaotic withdrawal from Afghanistan that raised questions about U.S. Staying power. It's the same question we're facing in Ukraine, and certainly if we pull out of Ukraine, having already done that in Afghanistan, there are going to be a lot of countries, Taiwan, Korea, Japan, plus the Philippines and many other countries in the Western Pacific, are going to be wondering, can we count on the United States? If a war breaks out, are they going to decide that it's just not worth it and, pull the forces away after some period of time? So it's not a military threat with Afghanistan. It is the question about U.S. Willingness to endure a conflict.
Well, sir, before we wrap up here, I'd like to ask is, for those listening, for those watching, are there specific takeaways or things, questions people should be asking, they should be thinking about as we march through this decade with all the conflict and potential conflict that exists out there?
There are a couple of things that I would suggest people think about. The first is, as we talked about in our discussion, bad things can happen. Surprises can happen. So even though people may believe that a Chinese attack on Taiwan is unwise, it could certainly occur. And we need to be ready for that. We need to have forces that can deter and if necessary, fight a conflict like that. When we look at Europe, the United States is committed to European security through NATO. That has been hugely successful. And unfortunately, the Europeans have shown that they are unable to organize themselves without U.S. leadership. Without the U.S., they mill about, despite having strong militaries and very powerful economies. They need U.S. leadership. We saw that during the war in Ukraine. And in the Middle East, we can see that, again, bad things happen, and the United States is not going to be able to withdraw the way some experts had recommended before the current hostilities. So many people have looked at the Middle East and said, you know, we ought to pull our forces back. This is a place where we can take some risk. And unfortunately, global events have a way of reminding us that global superpowers have global commitments and can't just walk away from them. So all three of these areas have potential dangers, but they are manageable with our allies if we are willing to make the investments. And I would, as a summary comment, note that these investments as a U.S. global superpower have paid off hugely. That is, they have safeguarded the U.S. economy, U.S. society. They have allowed us to become a wealthy nation. And if we step back from those commitments, my fear is not is that things would not continue as they are, but without the U.S. Presence and costs, but that there would be a fundamental reorientation of the global relations, that the Chinese would step in and they would have a global structure that would be very hostile to the United States, and that every American would feel, not just politically and internationally, but in their pocketbook.
Well, sir, I told a fib because you just brought up a good point that I would like to get your opinion on, which with talking about a power vacuum or the Chinese. We've seen the Chinese in Africa and now in South America. We talk BRIC countries, but the U.S. dollar having or being the staple of the world economy, what is the threat if the U.S. pulls back, or is it something that is stoppable if the U.S. is not involved in these places when we look with competing near-peer countries and trying to gain influence on the world stage?
The Chinese have made no secret of the fact that they want to displace the United States as the global premier power. And if they do that, then the United States is going to experience a lot of bad effects, and not just politically and diplomatically, but as I say, economically. For example, if the Chinese currency replaces the United States as the world's basis currency, then the world might not be buying all of our debt. And if the world doesn't buy our debt, then we're going to have a hard time with government programs. And that's one thing, defense. But if you're receiving Social Security or plan on receiving Social Security, well, we're financing that with debt. And if the world doesn't buy our debt, you're not getting your Social Security. So it affects everybody.
It's almost like a catch-22. You got to keep spending money and investing in these things in order for the dollar still to be the backbone of the economy. Interesting. Well, sir, again, I appreciate you joining me on the podcast. Down below, I have a link to the study with the war game, and I can provide any other links down there as well. But again, sir, thank you for joining me on the podcast today.
Well, thanks for having me on the program.
The Afterburn Podcast is a proud supporter of Guns, Gear, and Memorial Foundation, helping our veterans and their families when they need it most. To learn more, visit GunsGarin.com/rain.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
If you've struggled for years to lose weight and have given up hope, did you know you can now access GLP-1 prescription medications through LifeMD? LifeMD is now offering eligible patients online access to GLP-1s, the breakthrough prescription medication that can help you lose body fat and weight. Listen to what people are saying.
You just take your shot. It doesn't feel like you're on a diet. What I wasn't expecting it to do was to shut off the food noise. This was life-altering, and if I can do it, I feel like anybody can do it.
And here's the best part. Your insurance may cover 100% of the cost of your medication. So go to TryLifeMD.com to have your eligibility checked right now. Get started today at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.